Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. In this episode, I'm talking to Louisa Reed about her literary novel, The Poet. Louisa is an English teacher who lives near Manchester with her family. She's written novels for young adults exploring female empowerment and personal freedom, but The Poet is her first novel for adults and written in verse. In this episode, we discuss her love for and challenges of writing in verse, how writing in verse makes her focus on the crucial scenes of her novel, and why, to be a writer, you need to develop a thick skin. But first, here's Louisa with an excerpt from The Poet.
Michaelmas term. Hunger. There are students everywhere. Strutting magpies. They chatter in black gowns and white bow ties. Crowds of them, loudly matriculating. I wait and watch. Lean against a wall beneath a bridge of sighs, wearing a tight black dress and stupid heels that trip me up on the ancient stones. I wonder if I laughed as much when I was them, or smiled so widely. Can't remember where I went that day, what I did, with whom or why. Smoking a cigarette, I stab the wall with a stiletto and wait for you to come cycling up the lane, barrelling forwards, the rebuke of your bell, the chiming tinnitus of evening. I ought not to be here, wasting time, should be inside one of those book-lined rooms, safe in the refuge of paper and hard work. I have been attending to other things. In the last week, I have noticed the colour of turning leaves, vivid shocks of sun slicing across crenellated skies, and I have noticed the smell of the season, damp and rich, so dark it's almost black, and the rub of soil in my shoes between my toes. I have been thinking about how things rot and decompose, wishing I understood the chemistry of it, the biology and physics of degeneration, so that I might apply this understanding to loss of my own. Because if ideas can breathe, then surely they can lose the will to live. You shouldn't smoke, the man beside me says, his spectacles skew with breath, hot with port, ripe with cheese and opinion. I've forgotten his name and he won't know mine, but he's someone I should be trying to impress, gatekeeper, key holder, big swinging intellect. I should try at least to oil his hinges with the grease of my civility. I understand deference and the imperative to not embarrass you or myself, but tonight my head refuses to nod and my smile is a dead thing. I shrug and take out my lighter and a cigarette. Well, at least I'm still young enough to give up, I say, swinging my legs free from under the table, ignoring swivelling eyes and looks exchanged like a congress of ominous old birds. They stare. I walk away. The candlelight shudders and the faculty turn back to peck at their cheese and the state of the world, of which I am an apposite example, certain of their a priori assumptions about my behaviour. Young, too much lipstick and skin, silly, emotional, doesn't know what she thinks.
Hi, Louisa. Thank you for joining me on the podcast today to discuss your debut adult novel, The Poet.
Hello, it's so nice to be here with you, Chloe. Thank you for inviting me. It's just lovely to get the chance to chat about it. Thank you.
Yeah, and I love novels in verse. So as soon as I found out that that's what you were working on and that's what you'd written, I was really excited. So could you start by telling us what the poet is about?
I will. So the poet is the story of a young woman called Emma Elliott, and she is both poet and also academic. She's studying for a DPhil at Oxford University, and she's young, clever, talented, etc., etc. But she's at a point of sort of at the start of the book of despair and inaction, facing the hideous writer's block in all of her work. So the question is, really, why isn't there the relationship she has with the charming, clever, callous Tom doing her any good? And to what extent is that having an impact on this brilliant young woman? So it's a story, I think, of love gone bad, of revenge, of the power of a woman's words and believing, self-belief, and believing that your words have the worth to be heard.
And I wonder where that inspiration for you began, because I got the sense from it you were really keen on exploring this kind of like toxic relationship that Emma and Tom have and how it evolved from this whirlwind romance to something very disappointing and flattening for Emma. So can you tell us where it all began for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the toxic romance element of it it's a really interesting question, because Tom plays this role really of a force that is incredibly powerful, that pins down her imagination, pins down her self-worth, and kind of removes her belief. And I was just very interested through kind of over the years seeing how many women writers through the ages, artists, their work's been overshadowed or minimized by their male counterparts or by society, because the poetic tradition is kind of so masculine still. And I think that this idea of a woman floundering, feeling like she's not good enough, is something that loads and loads of people can associate with, whether you're in the writing world or whatever, or the academic world. It's something that resonates. And I name check a few, like Zelda Fitzgerald and Colette, these famous women writers who've either had bits of their work nicked or plagiarized, or they just haven't been heard, really. So that was where it came from, I think. And but Tom, for me, as well as being her lover, he stands for lots more. He stands for kind of patriarchy and status and power. So he's a symbolic figure as well as being an actual character in the story. And I don't know if you feel that came through, but that's what I felt about him. That in he was almost like a manifestation of all of those oppressive forces.
Absolutely. He is the personification of all these barriers in her way, not just herself, but academically and, like you say, in society. Did you feel that you were maybe channeling your own past frustrations with moving forward in your writing career, or like writer's block, self-doubt? Were those things that you channeled when you were writing this novel?
Oh yeah, completely. Yes. Yeah, but that's such an ever-present thing, isn't it? That like, oh, will it be good enough? Am I good enough? Is this writing worth reading? Will anybody want to? Does anybody care? It's the perennial question, isn't it? Over is my work good enough? And that comes pretty easily, I think, and is an interesting thing to explore. No, it's funny because you have books published, but there's still that nagging doubt and that question over, and the terrible thing of comparing yourself to others. Well, they're doing better than me. I must be doing something wrong here. What is it? Can I do better? And so on. I mean, we should never compare ourselves with others. I think it's just a hiding to nothing, isn't it? But yeah, I think those were rich seems to mine for me.
Yeah, but easier said than done not to compare yourself, I think.
Absolutely. So much easier said than done.
So let's talk about the form of your novel then, because we mentioned it's a novel in verse, and I love that form. I think it's absolutely great. I really love Sarah Crossman's, I forgot the title of it.
Here is the Beehive?
Here is the Beehive, yes. And I thought your novel really reminded me of that, because that is, I mean, it's exploring a different type of relationship, but it's got that intensity of I think that's what the verse brings to it, because I think it's, your novel packs a real punch, and obviously there's, because it's in verse, there's a lot less space, there's a lot less words than a kind of standard regular prose novel. Why verse then? What is it that appeals to you about writing in this way?
I just love it. And it's, I think it's because I've always been a big poetry fan, but one of the forms of poetry I really, really enjoy is a dramatic monologue, when that you get that character telling a story to the audience. And they're so fascinating to me, how you can marry up the kind of narrative, but also with the voice. So it's just, I guess, a kind of extension of that to a certain extent. The Charlotte New element of it, I know we can talk a little bit about that. It's kind of, I read her Farmer's Bride poem and I thought, oh, this is just amazing. The way she inhabits this different voice, but through poetry. And that's quite a short dramatic monologue, really. So I just kind of got hooked with the experimentation with it. As you say, because of the brevity, there's a punch to it and a power to it, and you're just getting on with it. And I find that very exciting as a writer, because I don't rarely feel bogged down, and I'm always kind of moving on, and there's a push forwards because of the succinct nature of it, and because you're trying to hone in and zoom in on those intense subjective feelings. And that also really works for me, the way I think, the way I feel, and getting into my character's head, trying to come as close to them as I possibly can. So I think I pretty much write all of my verse in first person, trying to make that character come through to the reader very, very closely, and picking the right words for it. I just love that the finding the perfect way to express the feeling, the emotion, the moment. It's something very, very satisfying about it.
Did you go into this novel knowing you were going to write it in verse?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. Because I can't really not write in verse now, but also the subject matter is so perfect for it, because it's about a poet who's writing about a poet, and the kind of the whole plot turns on the idea of words and language and who owns those words and that language. So I definitely went into it knowing that I was going to write this in verse, and I think it works well. I hope it works well. Somebody once asked me if there's any areas, subject matter, that's kind of off limits or wouldn't fit the verse novel, and I'm not sure. I need to think more about that. There may well be, I guess, if something was a bit dry, but if anything's about emotion or relationships or connections between people, that is always going to be, I think, a theme which fits poetry. So
and you mentioned Charlotte Mew, who Emma the narrator is writing about, and she's very caught up in Charlotte's life and her work. I didn't know who Charlotte Mew was when I read this novel and I looked her up, and I don't think you necessarily need to know about her, but can you, for the benefit of the podcast, tell us a little bit about Charlotte Mew and why she became your poet of choice and Emma's poet of choice?
Definitely. So I first came across her because, like you, I hadn't heard of this poet. And I've, despite having spent years in education and studying English and so on and so forth, but I first came across her when I was teaching a GCSE anthology, and this poem that I just mentioned, The Farmer's Bride, was in there. And so I looked her up to find out more about her and her work, because I thought, well, why don't I know about you? Because this is really amazing. And she fascinated me. Her life, her her, the time at which she was living, the way in which she was acknowledged in her lifetime as somebody with huge potential, but also talent all there, that she was Hardy and Sassoon and Wolfe. They were also, this is a great poet. This is a poet for generations to come. Everybody needs to know this writer's work. She's, you know, the real deal. And then nobody did know about her. She just got forgotten. And I found that fascinating how that can happen. She really had something. She really did different things with form, and she was somebody who wouldn't, you know, do what editors or publishers told her to do. This poem, The Farmer's Bride, the lines are so long that they kind of go off the end of the page, some of them, but instead of, so she wouldn't accept that she had to kind of short them down and for publication, she instead made the publisher do it landscape instead, so it would accommodate her vision of her work. So she was really feisty and tough, but at the same time kind of shy as well. And she had a very, very difficult life with a lot of familial illness, especially mental illness, and that impacted her work a lot and makes some of the themes extremely interesting. And I think she suffered, and that again is very interesting to see this woman, how she wrote such beautiful and interesting work that has, that each poem, I mean, could have 10, 20 other poems that would it be inspired by it, but yet her fame was so limited and she fell into such obscurity for so long. But I think she's coming out of that obscurity again now, which is wonderful to see. As I said, she's on a GCSE spec, she's in an A-level anthology as well. Julia Cope just wrote a couple of years ago the most amazing biography, This Rare Spirit, which is brilliant. That came out after I'd finished the first draft and got the deal with Doubleday. And I thought, oh, God, this book's come out. What if I've got it all wrong about Charlotte Mew? So I was reading, and it's so wonderful. It's a brilliant biography. And the stuff that I'd put in, fortunately, was right to the extent that it needed to be. There's a little bit of playing around with this idea of, did she write poems that she then rolled up and used as roll-ups to and smoked away? So was there a whole kind of work that was lost because she didn't believe in herself? And I don't know whether that or not that's true, but I played around with that notion. So yeah, she's just, for me, she's the most fascinating figure for her intelligence and her imagination and creativity and that kind of boundary breaking writing. Just love her.
And certainly she's a huge inspiration for Emma, and yes. Emma is the driving force of the story. And you've mentioned that for writing in verse, you feel like you have to have a really strong first person narrative, and you definitely do in this novel, because Emma's mindset is very passionate, but also because she's trapped, there's a feeling of frustration and anger, particularly directed towards Tom. Did you find that her voice came to you kind of quite instantly or quite easily? And how did you, if it didn't, how did you get into that mindset?
I think it came pretty easy. She spends quite a lot of the time being either angry or quite fed up. And I'd say that's probably me. I'm always like, but actually I spend quite a lot of time laughing at stuff as well and taking the mickey. So I think with her there was a fine line to tread as well, with making sure that she remained sympathetic and didn't become too kind of self-pitying or had any sort of unpleasant hubris. I think that's reserved for Tom, really. But yes, I really enjoyed her voice. I liked she can get a bit sweary at times. I guess that's also something that I enjoy too, and that's something I had to pull back on and not overdo it. But yeah, I think her voice came quite easily to me. She's a massive contrast in voice to the character I've just done in my latest YA activist, who does not suffer in silence. Emma spends too long in suffering in silence, perhaps, and I think some readers say,
just leave him, leave the bastard. But she goes about things in a slightly different way, more subtle, and bides her time, using her brain as a and her intellect to solve her problems. Whereas my new character in Activist, she's just in there straight away. That's not fair. You're not getting away with that. Not having any of it. And I think I'm much more, in terms of my approach to the world, maybe more like Emma than like Cassie in Activist. I don't like confrontation. I do anything to avoid it.
And I won't give away what Emma does and the way she uses her brain to outwit or solve her issue. But I thought it was delicious was the word that I used to describe it. It was incredibly satisfying. So tell us then about Tom, her lover and her former, I mean, he was her former lecturer. He is still a lecturer working at the university and absolutely, completely detestable, which is exactly what you wanted to achieve. So can you tell us a little bit about his character and how his effect on Emma, because he alters her sense of worth, and I guess it's subtle possibly when you're living through it, but when you're observing it like we are, it is awful to witness. So can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, so he's somebody who will go to any lengths, I think, to maintain his power and position. And he's drawn to Emma because he can see that she's very bright, very talented, but at the same time, he likes her best when she's weak, when she's broken. So it's that very interesting dynamic where somebody can use your talent almost, or that what is great about you to undermine you. And it's a play on the kind of teacher student, as you said, relationship, and that exploitation that can come with that when there's a power imbalance. And he understands and he knows that she idolizes him, that she idealizes him, and he can use that to his advantage. He's hot, hopefully. Well, she finds him hot, big, strong, sexy. She's mostly attracted to his brain, though, I think, which Emma believes is godlike. She puts him on this pedestal and he takes advantage of that. He uses that. And there's a real worm at his heart. But what's interesting, I think, about that kind of a character, Tom, is he doesn't even acknowledge his own cruelty. He can't really ever see it, that he does anything wrong. And he won't reflect on himself and take on board any criticism or even see a true reflection in the mirror. He sees what he wants to see. So she becomes that prisoner with the door wide open. She could leave, she could go, she could stop this, but she's imprisoned by the version of herself that he's made her believe that she is, until she sees the light. Hooray. But yes, I found him a fascinating character to write. There was even a moment where I felt a tiny bit sorry for him, which was awful. And I felt myself almost doing the Emma, like, oh, poor you. No, this is too cruel. I can't do this. But then in the end, I relished it and I just got on with it.
I struggled to see that you would feel sorry for him, but maybe a little moment of mortification on his behalf. But possibly not before that moment. I don't think you'd feel sorry for him.
It's only then.
So you mentioned that one thing you love about the writing in verse is that kind of the fact that you have to write the big scenes and the big moments and push the story forwards. Mm-hmm. I imagine that it poses its own challenges because you have to really pick your language and you have to pick your scenes very carefully, because there's no space for you to, you know, languish in describing a beautiful house or a tree or whatever you want to describe. You have got to kind of get to the point, and it's all got to be punchy and it's got to have that rhythm of the verse. So how did you go about that?
Well, I don't really plan it. I just do it. I feel it. And then I express it. I see those scenes like a film, very, very visually, at the same time as feeling them. I think there is a sense of place. There's the kind of streets and landscape of Oxford, the little house they live in, which she finds claustrophobic. But the place is always very closely connected to the emotion and seen through the emotion. So instead of kind of the majesty of that wonderful university city, Emma begins to find it a place of walls, a place of constriction that tightens around, or a maze where she's lost. So I'm always using everything, I guess, in terms of the setting and the movement, and the any description comes in via emotion and via the subjective experience. But I'm always thinking of it, as I said, scenically, in scenes where we're here, we're moving on, we're always going forward. So there is that narrative drive. So you can't, as you say, languish too long with anything overtly descriptive, because I'm trying to propel my reader to keep them going, to keep them engaged in the verse. But yes, I'm not really one for sitting down and plotting those scenes out. They just kind of seem to follow on as if that is it's all kind of unraveling before you, like a film does. I don't know if that makes sense.
What is it like then to edit? Because I imagine you're there with a kind of scalpel. You can't suddenly chop huge amounts away, because that will spoil the rhythm and the way the verse unfolds. So what is that like? Or do you find that you don't have to edit in a big way?
Yeah, there was one of my verse novels, Wrecked, I had to edit in a big way. And that was a major change in terms of chronology and things. So I changed what was just kind of start at the beginning and finish at the end to a courtroom scene over 3 days with loads of flashbacks in it. That was hell on earth to edit. It was just like a terrible jigsaw. My brain was aching. But with this one, you're right. It was more like going back in with a scalpel and sharpening things until they were doing, till the words, the language was working as hard as it possibly could be, and taking out any kind of unnecessary repetition or just paring back. But adding in as well, actually, once I got into the editing process, I think I wrote some of the best bits of the book, because I felt, it's funny, isn't it? Somebody had said, yeah, this is a good book. We want to buy this book. We want to publish this book. We want to celebrate. And that gave me the faith and confidence I needed to go even further and better with it. Does that ring any chime, anything with you? Do you find that in editing, after you've kind of got the deal, that's when the best stuff comes?
Yeah, and I think there's a level of emotional detachment as well, because you're further away from the point that you actually cried and sweated and bled all over your words. So when you're removing them and taking out the fluff, it doesn't feel as painful, because you yes. don't remember that day on a Wednesday afternoon where you sat there staring at the screen for 3 hours and not writing anything. And the words were dragged out of you. But I mean, sometimes I can remember the scenes that were difficult or particularly challenging, and you know, I took a long time agonizing over. But I think the thing to remember is that the reader doesn't ever see that part of it. And that's quite interesting, because I found the only time I ever can detach like that is when I listened to the audiobook, because I couldn't see the seams, if you see what I mean. It all worked as one for me, whereas when I was reading it as a text, I'm like, oh, that scene, that one that I struggled over.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I know what you mean. It's a different experience, isn't it? It becomes the kind of artifact almost that you are able to see slightly more objectively.
Definitely.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You've obviously written novels in verse for young adults and you're comfortable with that form and you really enjoy it. But was there a part of you that was nervous or was worried about writing a novel in verse for adults? Because I think things are changing. I think we're seeing more experimental forms, shorter novels, novellas, things like that becoming more popular. But did you ever feel that nerves of, I mean, obviously you sold the book, but was there ever a moment where you were like, is this gonna work? Is this gonna sell?
Yeah, definitely, completely. I was wary. I wasn't sure there was a huge appetite out there for verse novels. I mean, you mentioned Sarah Crossan and there's other brilliant experimental fiction, absolutely, like Bernardine Evaristo, one of my favourite poets who also writes that, I guess, I feel like they're verse novels. She's called Anne Carson. She's absolutely amazing. There are the verse novels out there. If you can find them, but you've got to go digging, you've got to go hunting a bit. It's not like that everybody's going to say, oh yes, I know exactly, I've got this suggestion for you, why don't you read this one. You do need to seek them out. So I did wonder, would this be a project that a publisher would take the risk with? Would it be the sort of project that a reader will want to try? And some people are put off instantly the word you say poetry. They think novel in verse, what, a novel written in poems? No way, because they hate poems, because maybe they've had a bad experience at school, or they just think it's an elitist thing where you can't get into it because it's going to be so tricky and difficult. But happily, I think people, if they do try it, they soon realize that because it's free verse, it's the organic rhythms of natural speech that it carries them forward. Actually, it's propulsive rather than being repellent. So people say, oh, they forget they were reading a novel in verse, which is interesting in itself, isn't it? And maybe, I don't know, that's because of the plot, perhaps, that I don't, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I'm not sure. But it's certainly a tricky thing, because you are going to potentially alienate readers by saying that's the form of it. But then again, readers will get alienated if you say, well, that's a fantasy novel. They'll say, well, I don't like that. That's a romance, I don't like that. So you can't win. We can't win everybody over. Yeah.
You're never going to get everyone reading a book or everyone liking a book. But yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because I don't really read poetry. And I've always felt like don't get it, don't understand it, and I worry that it will all go over my head. But I think I have taken a chance on a couple of novels in verse and love them. And I think it's the way, I guess, poetry, if you love it, makes you feel, because it's so visual and it's quite an exciting form for a novel. And I think if anyone is a bit cautious about it or nervous about reading a novel in verse, I would say give it a go, because you'd be surprised how accessible it is, because because there is a story running through it, and it's, you know, it's speedy, it's quite pacey to read. And so if you're someone that's thinking, oh, I don't really get poetry, I don't read it, or I don't like it, give novels in verse a go, because I think it's a different experience, and it doesn't give you that feeling of you're in school and you've got to analyze the poem or anything like that. It's a different feeling, I think.
Yes, completely. And it's, I think that's why it's great for young adults as well, because the brevity, the page turning, because there's so few words on a page, there's that sense of, oh yeah, I'm getting through this.
Racing through this.
And that's great, because you want to, we want to encourage, as an English teacher, I want to encourage reading as much and as widely as possible. So I feel like novels in verse, especially for young adult readers, are a brilliant, brilliant way to get kids engaged in language, in story, in seeing the beauty and power of books. And I don't see why that shouldn't work for adult readers as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, let's talk about your career as a young adult writer, because you've written a few books for young adults, and I just wondered really how that kind of conversation went with your agent. Did you change agents? I wondered what that process was. When did you make that decision that you were gonna write for adults?
Well, I didn't really, and I didn't change my agent. I didn't tell my agent I was doing it, I don't think, or I might have mentioned it in passing and she didn't say, what the hell are you thinking? Stop now. I just did it. I just felt like it. So I did it. I'm not very good at being strategic about things. I just do what the mood takes me. And fortunately, Jessica Hare, my agent, she loves novels in verse. She absolutely adored it. And she gave me, again, the confidence to say, yeah, this is great, go for it. And she took, so she is a children's writer's agent, but she was so wonderful in just thinking, yeah, we're going to do this, we're going to get it out there. So I was absolutely delighted that she was on board with it. If she hadn't been on board, I would have been gutted. And then I would have had to go off and find someone who would represent it, wouldn't I? That would have been a bit of a pain, but thank God for Jessica.
She must have been so impressed to agree to kind of represent that novel, if her experiences within children's and young adult fiction, for her to take a an adult novel to submission is incredible, really. It's just a sign of how strong she felt the book was.
Yeah, she's brilliant. Yeah, lucky.
Do you think there's any significant differences between writing for adults and writing for young adults? Swearing.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say about that. I did mention the swearing, didn't I? I think when I had 50 or plus F words, so I won't say it. It's a podcast. We don't want to be swearing on the podcast.
Swear, it's fine.
All right. I had to whittle them down, and I think I got about sit down to about 10 or 12. So that's pretty good going, isn't it, really? I think that the books, but for young adults and adults, everybody wants a good story, whether you're a teenager or a grown-up. I think maybe there is a bit more room in my adult writing for me to be a bit more introspective, ask a bit more of the reader, to allow greater kind of internal monologue, but that's there in my young adult as well. I think I'm still dealing with hard-hitting stuff in both thematically. Maybe I can be more brutal about the bleaker and darker aspects in adult, but both books have hope, both are kind of across those age ranges. The hope is, I think, there, and not all is lost. Maybe there's a bit more sex in the poet than, or implied. It's not graphic by any means. But I've done that in young adults as well. So I think it's largely similar. I'm just aging up the protagonist, aging up the other characters, and taking on the themes from young adult that may be in the more adult context. So whereas in Activist, I'm dealing with a school and kind of the problems of inequality in school. In The Poet, it's university world, the world of work. And for those reasons, it's more perhaps more applicable, relatable to the adult reader than to the young adult reader. But I don't know. So I think there's a lot of similarities really in what I'm doing, but I have just gone for it with my language in The Poet, where as in my young adult, maybe I'm not being quite so demanding in terms of the vocabulary, the imagery, that etc. But it's still pretty, I'd hope it's still rich.
Do you have any advice for anyone that's kind of wanting to make that switch between writing for different age groups? Is there anything that you would say you would advise them to do or not do?
Just read loads. I mean, that's always the thing, isn't it? You've got to know your market. So I don't think you can be a young adult writer if you don't ever read any young adult books, and vice versa. So that's key. Another thing is just be brave, have a go, see if you can do it. Why not? I didn't know if I could, but I just thought I'm challenge yourself. I mean, it's good, isn't it, to try keep things fresh and different and mix it up a bit. So I really enjoyed the challenge of it. And yeah, I think don't limit yourself.
So can you tell us a little bit about your writing routine? As I know, you're an English teacher as your day job, very demanding job. I've spoken to a couple of other teachers on the podcast before. I'm a former teacher myself, and I know how much of a difficult job it is and what a time consuming job it is as well. So do you have a set time you write? Are you fitting it around your job? Do you have, do you write on weekends? What's your method?
When I started, I was one of those, and my kids were small, I was a 1,000 words a day person, and I sat down when the children were in bed and I did my 1,000 words a day, and that's how I did finish Black Heart Blue, and was where it just went, got it done. Now I've become so idle. I am just awful. I'm faffing around, messing about. I blame the internet, actually. It's Twitter, it's Instagram, it's all of that rubbish.
I never
used to be on any of those things, so they do spoil a lot for me, and I should just leave. But you know,
I don't know. I do find that sometimes I'm a big Twitter fan, but I find I see other people going, I've written 3,000 words a day, and then I'm like, now it means I have to go and do some.
Yes, exactly. I've just joined your club, which I can't come to tonight because it's parents' evening, but I am going to be at your writing rooms from here on in, because it's on a Thursday, and Thursday is usually my day off, in inverted commas. So I'm working 4 days a week now with just one day, which also I need to do school visits on. So I do try and do a bit at the weekends. That's really the time. But it's I've become a bit, as I said, lazy with it, and I need to up the ante again. And I need to get back into a routine. But I think when you have a book out, because The Poet was June and then Activist has been just today, published today, there's almost like, where's the space in that for me to be working on a new thing? And it's a bit difficult, but I have started something new. I just needed more thinking time with it, though. I think I'm getting there with the, what is this really about?
Yeah.
Because you got to, until I really know that, then stuff isn't as good as it could be. So
that's something that comes later, though, I think, isn't it? You don't start on page one with, I'm going to write a novel about this, and it's going to be thematically exploring this. I think that comes out in the writing process.
Definitely.
So is there anything you know now as a published author that you wish you'd known right back at the beginning before you started?
You need your skin as thick as a rhinoceros's. Nobody said that. The amount of resilience required is huge, isn't it? Mm. And I thought when I first was published in 2012, I thought, oh, that's it. I'm an author now. Well, hey, it's done and dusted. But it's not like that at all. You will always be having to start again, really, with each book. There's, mm-hmm. Yes, you'd start, begin to get a readership, perhaps, or people who support you and a group sharing. But I feel like every time it's again, I'm beginning at the beginning. So yeah, the resilience, the thick skin, and just quite how difficult it is to sell books, I think, is something that's a revelation to me.
Yeah. So you already briefly touched on it just a minute ago, but can you tell us anything about what you're writing next?
Well, I think it's definitely going to be another novel in verse. So that is one thing. It will be a first person perspective about a woman. And she is going to, it's going to be for adults. So I'm going to try and get another adult one before I do any more young adults. And it will be about tricky relationships. Yeah, it's going to be around women and their love stories, I guess, but not in a very positive way. It's going to be another dark doing, but maybe this character is perhaps more wicked than she ought to be.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm still working through it all. I'm still working through it all, but she's going to be deeply, deeply flawed.
As the best characters are,
yes.
Louisa, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you so much. Been really, really lovely to chat. Thank you.
That was Louisa Reed talking about her literary novel, The Poet, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.